Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, delivering programs from the golden age of radio. Mark Levonier, your host for an hour of continuing series. We'll be following stories with episodes 3 of Marco Polo, The Man in the Iron Mask, and episode 9 of Firefighters later on. But first, it's part 3 of 5 of The Valentine Matter on yours truly, Johnny Dollar, a CBS episode from November 2nd, 1955.
From Hollywood, it's time now for...
Johnny Dollar.
This is Ann Ward, Mrs. Valentine. Have you heard anything about Dan?
Nothing, Mrs. Valentine. The police are looking everywhere for him.
I went to the hospital tonight and they told me he walked out. He might die, Mr. Dollar.
I know, Mrs. Valentine.
Did you tell anyone I was here in New Orleans?
If you mean did I mention it to the police, no.
Thank you, Mr. Dollar. That was very kind of you.
But it makes me mad that I didn't, Mrs. Valentine. I know you don't want anybody to find you're related to him because of your daughter. But I also think you could help the police in this situation. You could help them find Dan and put him back in a hospital.
Mr. Dollar, would you come over and talk to me, please? Please.
Tonight and every weekday night, Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account, America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to the New Britain Mutual Insurance Company, Hartford, Connecticut. The following is an accounting of expenditures during my investigation of the Valentine matter. Some more expense. I believe this is item 5. Yeah, $4. 4 drinks for myself. When a next big shot of the Roaring Twenties like Dan Valentine carries a $50,000 life insurance policy and walks down the street one day and gets himself shot and refuses to disclose who fired the bullets, I have to do the worrying for the insurance company. When he decides to leave a hospital bed minus a pint or two of blood, I have to worry some more. I needed those drinks. You can just say I liked what I'd seen of the guy, and I didn't want him to walk around New Orleans bleeding to death.
In here, please, Mr. Dollar.
The wife, who hadn't seen or heard from him for 13 years, looked pale and wan. It was obvious that the strain was beginning to tell on her, although she tried hard not to show it.
Doesn't it ever cool off in New Orleans?
Sometimes. But I'm not here to talk about the weather, Mrs. Valentine. You know that.
Yes, I know.
Well, don't just stand there and give me the tears, then. If you've got anything to say, say it. If you know anything that'll help, let me know about it.
You're perfectly right in being angry with me. Mr. Dollar, I honestly don't know where Dan is.
Well, do you know why he'd get up out of a hospital bed and endanger his life?
I have an idea he might have wanted to see somebody.
Who?
I don't know.
The two men who shot at him?
Perhaps. I just don't know.
We aren't getting anywhere, Mrs. Valentine. Look, I'm going to talk to you frankly. Why did he come here to live in New Orleans?
Well, I...
You live in New England with your daughter, Teresa. Obviously, Dan thinks a great deal of you and her. He's given you everything, provided for you, with all of his troubles. Spent 13 years in prison. I can imagine his thoughts about you and her while he was in there. And yet he comes out and lives 2,000 miles away from you.
He didn't want to interfere with Teresa in any way.
Sure, but it seems to me he'd want to look at you, at her, certainly. Even if it was a matter of living in Boston and taking a bus to New Salem and standing on a street corner one day to watch the two of you cross the street. That sound reasonable to you?
If you put it that way.
Well, look, there's some reason he picked New Orleans. Some reason he didn't give himself the little gratification of just looking at you and Teresa. Why? Why here?
I'm sure I don't know.
And why is he running around now?
I can't answer that either.
But it must have something to do with you and your daughter. Obviously, you're the only ones he ever cared about. Well?
I honestly don't know.
Well, and I can't help you, and I can't help myself or him.
You mentioned his having a reason to be in New Orleans. Maybe...
What?
There was a man named Webster, Conrad Webster. He was a member of the Illinois Bar once in those days. Did a great deal of work for Dan and friends of Dan. I think he lived here.
Wait a minute, I've seen that name... Yeah, on copies of the insurance policy. A man named Webster had the power of attorney. Yes. He bought the insurance... There's a trust in there for your daughter.
Yes, Conrad Webster was an old friend of Dan's. I don't even know whether he's alive now or not. He drank a great deal later on. think he lived here.
Was he the kind of friend Dan would go to if he needed help?
Yes, I think so.
All right.
What are you going to do?
It's just something to look into. I'll try and find Webster, and maybe I can find your husband.
Thank you for coming by. I needed somebody to talk to. What?
I hope he stays alive, Mrs. Valentine. Item 7, $16. The money it cost me to find out the location of Conrad Webster. I started at his last known address, followed a series of bars, and finally got information from a bartender that led me to the crummier half of a decaying duplex on Gentilly Street. Everything was quiet for Gentilly Street.
Young man, the drugstore delivers what I need most. The telegraph office, what I dread most. Obviously, you represent neither, and therefore you are no concern of mine.
Wait a minute. Are you Mr. Webster? Conrad Webster?
I am he, and I am drunk and disheveled, and it is 3 o'clock in the morning.
I'd like to talk with you. May I come in?
You may not.
This isn't exactly the hour for making calls, but I did stop by and pick up something to take the edge off.
Did?
Huh? It's bonded.
Oh, inside. Now then, you were going to apologize.
Here you are, Mr. Webster.
Oh, well. Now then, as long as this lasts, you will last.
All right. I'm looking for a man.
The entire world is looking for a man. Just one man. A man they blindly presume will break off these shackles that bind us and lead us forth into eternal justice.
Yeah, sure, but that's not why.
An ironic anticipation.
I'm talking about Dan Valentine.
You are?
Yes, I'm a friend of his.
No, you don't come from that place. The pallet is not with you. You lie.
I didn't say I was in jail with him.
And where else would he have made friends these long years?
He's out of prison now. He's been out for 3 months.
And I'm aware of that.
Did you know he was shot at yesterday? 3 hours ago, he left his hospital bed. I thought he might have come to you. Is he here?
He is not.
Do you know where he is?
I do not.
Mr. Webster, if Valentine isn't back in the hospital pretty soon, he'll die.
Why is the phenomenon of death so persistently alarming? So he will die. They all die. Usually from a bullet.
And that's what's going to happen to him. 2 bullets he stopped yesterday. Do you understand me?
Acutely. You've impressed me with the urgency of his situation. But Dan Valentine is not here, nor has he been here, nor has he contacted me, nor do I know where to contact him.
All right, Mr. Webster, all right. I guess I believe you.
Your concern for him is a distressing irritation. What is the reason for it?
I'm an insurance investigator, and it's my job to keep him alive. More than that, I like him. I told you I was his friend. I think he deserves to live.
You, his friend? No. You are too young to be his friend. His friends, for the most part, are gone. Like the long years. Like Homburg hats and the Charleston and Lime Ricky. The ones who are left are broken and tired and faded. With old faces. Faces like mine. Like his. And we should be gone, too. Another age is here. This is my sadness. As for yours, Dan Valentine should never have lived in that age or this age. He was meant to be an explorer, a pioneer who conquered a wilderness, not a racketeer who conquered a west side.
Are you sure you're his friend, Mr. Webster?
I once thought so. He once thought so. Now, I haven't strength enough to be anyone's friend. What's your name?
Johnny Dollar.
Good night, Mr. Dollar.
The look in Conrad Webster's eyes held the same sort of sadness I had seen in Valentine's eyes. But they were different, too. They held a weakness. The strong, sad eyes were somewhere else in the city, walking alone, probably looking for two gunmen, and the lifeblood was slowly draining from the body that sparked them. I went back to my hotel and tried to sleep, but sleep wouldn't come. I was still rolling and tossing at 7:30 the next morning when orange juice coffee in the morning paper came up. A nationwide syndicate had picked up the new development in the Valentine shooting and gone to work on it. Among other names they mentioned in giving a resume of Valentine's career were his wife and daughter, living in New Salem under the name of Ward.
Hello?
This is Johnny Dollar. I just read the morning paper, Mrs. Valentine.
Oh, yes.
I'm sorry it broke for you this way.
That's very kind of you to say so. Maybe it's for the better, anyhow. For years, I've been wanting to tell Teresa who her father is, what he's like. I'm going to call her later today. Tell her where I am, explain why I'm here. I think she can take it.
You're doing pretty well yourself.
Thanks again. Any word yet?
No. No, we still can't find him.
Mr. Webster, did you find him?
Yes, he wasn't much help.
The New England paper said that Mrs. Ward was out of town. Sooner or later, they'll find out what town Mrs. Ward is in, I'm afraid.
Well, maybe you'd better get another hotel. Use another name.
Yes.
All right, I'll wait to hear from you.
Mr. Dollar.
Yes?
Thank you.
I put in another call to Inspector DeBaca and asked him about developments. Valentine was still unlocated. They were covering drugstores and doctor's offices where he might seek assistance. The two unidentified men who had shot him were still unidentified. The police weren't able to dig up any more witnesses or get any line on the car. By 4 in the afternoon, Mrs. Valentine had still not called me to report a new address. I got worried and went over to the Roosevelt to see what was what. I was surprised to see Inspector DeBaca in the lobby talking to the bell captain.
All right, son. If you remember anything else, call me here.
Yes, sir. I sure will.
Hi.
Hi, Dollar. Well, you want to talk first or you want me to? All right, I'll talk first. Mrs. Valentine's been staying here under the name of Ann Ward. You knew that.
Yeah.
Why didn't you say anything to me?
She asked me not to.
Doesn't make any difference now, anyhow. That boy over there called us a little while ago. He said that Dan Valentine came in here this afternoon, went upstairs, came back down 15 minutes later with Mrs. Valentine. They both left together.
Yeah, he must have seen the story in this morning's paper and guessed she was in town.
That's the way I see it. Well, we're right back where we started from, and I'm about sick of it.
We're a little better off. Two people are easier to find than one. We found them, all right, at 7 o'clock that night, and it was easy. Three squad cars were already drawn up in front of the little hotel, and I noticed with a sinking heart that a hearse was there also. Dan Valentine and his wife were dead.
There'll be another intriguing episode in our story of the Valentine matter tomorrow.
Tomorrow, proof that the murder of Dan Valentine and his wife aren't the only murders to be solved. Join us, won't you? Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 2nd of November 1955 on CBS. This is an hour of continuing series on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for The Adventures of Marco Polo, Episode 3 from this 1940 syndicated series.
We now present The Adventures of Marco Polo. Marco Polo was kidnapped by his father and uncle and taken aboard a vessel bound for Beirut. Marco Polo protested at the treatment he was receiving, but after talking with his servant Benno, he decided to make the best of the situation. Eventually, the vessel arrived at Beirut, and the party proceeded overland in the direction of Persia. They crossed the trackless desert, having engaged many bearers and beasts of burden. Marco Polo began to feel the joy of traveling, but he bemoaned the fact that the party was not meeting with many adventures. At last they came to a huge mountain, and high up on the side of the mountain they saw a large, well-fortified castle. Their servant Benno informed them that this was the castle occupied by an eastern prince known as the Old Man of the Mountain. And it is of interest to note that later travelers bore out the absolute truth of Marco Polo's story of the Old Man of the Mountain, who was the origin of many tales of folklore. Marco Polo and his party were attacked by soldiers coming from the mountain stronghold. They were surrounded and captured and carried to the castle. There they were placed in a dungeon to await their fate.
A fine ending to my travels, to die like a rat in a dungeon.
Marco, my son, you have courage, have you not?
I have courage, father. Courage to fight. But how can I fight when I see no enemies?
I have heard much of the Old Man of the Mountain. I wonder if we will set eyes on him. Have courage, Marco. Mayhap it is not the will of this prince that we should die.
We were outnumbered. There was no chance to fight to save ourselves. Come, Benno, tell me some of the stories you have heard of the Old Man of the Mountain.
Oh, they say he is indeed a wicked prince who has lived in this mountain stronghold for many years. Did you observe the gold and silver adornments in the castle as we were brought in? Did you observe the rich jeweled headdresses of the men-at-arms?
All those I observed.
Spoils plundered from defenseless travelers, I am told.
Aye, master. Spoils plundered from defenseless travelers. All our goods, all our treasures have been stolen. But I have heard strange tales of this Prince Alowadin, who is called the Old Man of the Mountain. They say his warriors were all forced into his service, that he bewitches them by means of a strange drug which is called hashish.
I have heard of the drug hashish. Perhaps that is why they call the soldiers of the Old Man of the Mountain hashishians. They are the most murderous and deadly rogues in the whole world. They take this drug before they go into battle.
Hark. Someone approaches. They are unlocking the door of the dungeon.
You are to be taken into the presence of the Prince Alardin, he who is called the Old Man of the Mountain. You will prostrate yourselves before him, and he shall decide your fate.
I shall prostrate myself before no robber tyrant.
Peace, Marco. No harm can come from your prostrating yourself. You will learn it is wise to humor these strange people.
Remember, we desire to leave here alive.
Come, follow me. And if you do not prostrate yourself before the prince, then will your head be struck from your shoulders.
Perforce we must obey. But we will not show fear, although our lives are at stake.
The officer and the soldiers led Marco Polo and his party through the great hall of the castle, and the travelers were bewildered to see that the walls were hung with cloth of gold. The marble pillars were inlaid with lapis lazuli. The clothes of the attendants glittered with diamonds, rubies, and precious stones. At last the party came to a halt before a door which appeared to be made of solid gold. Outside this door was a huge gong. The officer drew his sword and struck the gong.
Never have I seen such wonders, my father. Never such wealth.
See, the golden doors are opening.
Oh, I am afraid. We ought to go into the presence of the Old Man of the Mountain.
Follow me.
Look, a great tiled hall.
There is a fountain playing in the center of the hall, casting colored splashes of water. Never have I beheld such wonder.
Look at the end of the room. There is a throne, and on it sits a fat old man.
Doubtless the Old Man of the Mountain.
Come, we are being led before him.
Strangers, cast yourselves down. Prostrate yourselves before Prince Alardin, who is called the Old Man of the Mountain.
Willingly we prostrate ourselves before the mighty prince.
Come, Marco. Make your obeisance.
Why does the young man not prostrate himself?
He is amused with wonder at the many sights which he has beheld. Come, Marco. Do not be foolish. Obey.
I obey. We prostrate ourselves before the Prince of Lourdes.
You may rise, strangers. I give you greeting to my mountain kingdom.
The most high and mighty prince is gracious.
Bring carpet, that the strangers may seat themselves before me.
May we seat ourselves in your presence, O mighty one?
I have said that you may, O sour-faced man.
Marco, be silent.
It seems that the mighty Prince Alurdan has a discerning eye.
You are a tall young stripling and proud. You hesitated before making obeisance to me.
For that I ask your pardon, mighty prince.
It is well. You may seat yourselves now. Who is your leader?
I am the leader, O mighty prince. The tall young man is my son. This man on my right is my brother, and the other man is our servant.
It is not fitting that a servant should sit with his masters. Let him sit alone behind you.
Benno, sit behind us.
Tell me, what have you heard of me?
We have heard that you are a mighty prince, that you have lived in this castle for many years, holding it against all comers, that you are one of the richest princes in the world, and we have come to pay our respects to you.
You were brought to pay your respects to me. You did not come willingly. Whither are you bound?
We are bound for Persia, where we carry a message from the Pope of Rome to the Khan of Persia. We are but peaceful traders, mighty prince, meaning harm to no one, and we would seek your friendship.
The Khan of Persia is no friend of mine. Oft times has he sworn to make the road safe for travelers. Oft times has he tried to defeat me, to drag me out of my castle. But always we have remained safe, and his army has retired. Now I would speak with a young man, your son. Tell me, stripling, what think you of the wonders you behold?
I am bewildered, O mighty prince.
You are tall, strong, young. I have need of men like you in my army, my Hashishin.
O mighty prince, my son comes with us on our journey.
Your son can be of much use to me. Look you at my soldiers who stand about this great hall. They are chosen because of their strength, their height, their prowess in war. What name has this young man?
My name is Marco Polo.
Marco Polo, would you like to join my army?
Your Highness, I appreciate the honor you put upon me, but I must go on my journey with my father and my uncle.
They are useless old men. There is not much of life left to them, but you can stay here amidst riches, luxury, and mayhap you will meet many beautiful women.
Many?
Many beautiful women.
Many beautiful women?
Ah, my friend, I see the light of interest in your eyes.
Would you spare the lives of my father, my uncle, and my servant if I remain here in your service, O mighty prince?
I might find tasks for them in the castle. But know you that I am called the Old Man of the Mountain, and that I have powers greater than Allah himself.
Indeed, mighty prince, I have heard much of your power.
Those who are my friends can be transported to paradise. Do you know what paradise is like, Marco Polo?
I have not the same faith as you, mighty prince. I am a Christian.
Paradise is the same for Christians as Muslims. Think. Beautiful women with dark, bewitching eyes. Silken divans in which you may recline at ease. Rich, rare wines and perfume. Ease, luxury, happiness, and all that the heart can desire. Is that not paradise, Marco Polo?
It is not the Christian paradise.
It is the Muslim paradise. And I shall send you to paradise. With your father, your uncle, and your servant.
Does that mean we are to die, O most mighty prince?
It means that you will be sent to paradise. But come, let us be friends.
A moment, mighty prince. I beg that you let my uncle, my father, and my servant live. If you command me to stay here to serve you, I will obey your orders.
You cannot stay here, Marco. Better to die with us.
Why fear death if death will take you to paradise? But come. You shall drink priceless wine with me before you go on your way to paradise. Bring wine for my guests and wine for the old man of the mountain.
We do not wish your wine.
Would you refuse to drink with me? Know you not that that is a deadly insult?
I feel I need wine, something to revive my flagging courage.
Well spoken. The wine is being handed to you.
Note the cups are of solid gold, studded with rubies and amethysts. A treasure robbed from the caravan of a wealthy Khan. And such wine as this needs gold and jeweled cups. It is the wine of the gods. Drink, my friends.
May happy means to be friendly to us, Father.
I have heard it said that if these people offer hospitality and you accept it, then they will not take your life.
Well, come then, let us drink.
My friends, I pledge you in this priceless wine. May you have a quick and safe journey to paradise. Come, drink. It is the same wine as Prince Alauddin drinks.
We drink, O mighty prince, and pledge to you our loyalty and friendship.
It is well. Does the servant drink too?
I drink, O mighty prince.
Your cup is but of silver, because you are a servant. But you have the same wine. Is the wine to your taste, my friend?
Never have I tasted such wine.
It is indeed the nectar of the god.
Drain it to the last drop as I have drained mine, and hurl the jeweled cup away. Hurl them, I say, as I hurl mine. Speak, Marco Polo. Was the wine to your liking?
It was to my liking, Most High.
You do not care to stay here, where priceless jeweled cups mean naught to us, where we can hurl them away because we have others of greater value? Do riches mean nothing to you, Marco Polo?
I would fain go on my journey with my father and my uncle.
You are bound on another journey. Do your eyes grow heavy?
Of a truth, my eyes do grow heavy.
The wine was drugged. I swear it.
Oh, my master, I am dying. And that wine was poisoned.
Aye, the wine was poisoned.
Oh,
this devilish prince desires that we should die.
Ah, my friends, the wine is working. You drank. You raised the wine. But know you that you are now on your way to paradise.
I shall not die without striking a blow.
Marco, what ails you?
Get out of the floor.
Already he's on his way to paradise. You shall meet him there. Your journey has started, my friend. To paradise! To paradise!
The Adventures of Marco Polo on Tuned to Yesterday, a syndicated episode from 1940. Now on to Firefighters with the ninth in a series of broadcasts, first heard on November 24th, 1949.
Stand by all stations.
Attention, all districts. A five-alarm fire. Five bells. Move in immediately.
That's it. Let's roll.
Let's go. Firefighters.
Presenting Firefighters. The true-to-life story of our unsung heroes who stand ready to ride by day or night against our most murderous enemy, the demon of fire. Let's go, firefighters. Let's go to the roof of the burning warehouse where you remember Tim Collins, rookie fireman, just a moment ago, began searching for the fireman he is supposed to relieve. He can see a shaft of smoke rising from the other end of the roof, where the hook and ladder man smashed the skylight. But as the wind rises, the smoke smothers him in a billowing cloud.
Murphy! Hey, Murphy!
Oh, gotta work up into that smoke. Can't see anything here.
Hey, Murphy, sound off. Here's your relief.
Oh, what's that?
Oh, an axe. Murphy dropped it. Hey, Murphy, where are you? Sound off, I can't find you.
Oh, good grief. Here he is, he's out cold. Oh, let's see, this axe and can opener, I'll drop him right here. I hope I can find him again. I'll get my arms under him. A good man. He has a coil of rope fastened to the tools and let it pay out behind us. Yeah. Okay, Murphy. Here we go. I'm going to lift you. Oh, up we go, Murphy. Up. Now to work through the smoke. Up into the wind, Murphy. We'll get behind the smoke there. Oh, Now it's thinning out. I can see daylight. There's the edge of the roof.
The edge of the roof?
Yeah. Yeah, we're almost there, Murphy. Hey, you answered me.
Who are you?
I'm your relief. Oh, but never mind now. I'll sit there. Let you down. Now I'll sit there and breathe.
All right, I'm all right, kid. I'm all right.
You will be soon. I'll haul in the axe and the can opener and let you down to the ground on the line. You need a little first aid, Murphy.
First aid your foot. I'm a smoke eater from way back. Who are you?
Tim Collins, your relief.
Relief? I don't need any relief. What I need is an extra pair of hands. There's heat building up under this roof, Collins. We've got to let it out.
I found you right at the hot spot. That's where you ought to break through.
Right. Come on, Collins. I'll show you how to use that can opener.
All right.
Hey, Murphy,
take it easy.
My legs gave out.
Yeah, well, you'll be all right in a minute. You sit here and clear out the rest of that smoke from your lungs.
You know what to do? You punch through the roof and work ahead of the smoke so the wind pulls it out like the draft in a chimney.
Yeah, I know. Work right into the smoke, even if it chokes me. All right, when you're ready, you come ahead. I'll leave the lifeline so you can find me.
Kennedy.
Yes, sir?
Who's that man up on the roof? That isn't young Collins.
Why, that's Murphy, Chief Cody. Looks as if he got a lung full of smoke.
Now he's moving around. He's all right. He's trying his arms and legs.
He's an old-timer, Chief. Sooner breathe smoke than air, some of these old truckmen. Sir, the boys with the hose lines at the back of the warehouse...
Haven't they hit that tire yet?
The fire door on the third floor blew out just after Collins climbed past him.
What's keeping them? Why haven't they gone into that third floor at the back?
Smoke's too heavy, rolling down the stair shaft. Four men have been carried out. They can't get in until the hook and ladder boys open up the roof.
I'll give Collins and Murphy a minute more. If they don't control the situation by then, send some more men up a ladder.
Yes, sir. Danvers, Garrison, stand by at the truck.
And Lieutenant Kennedy.
Yes, sir.
Was anybody in the warehouse when the fire began? Are all workmen accounted for?
All but the watchman, sir. We cleared the first and second floors.
If he was on the third, he's past carrying now.
He may have been on the fourth, right above the fire, but that's full of smoke, Chief, even if the flames haven't yet broken through.
If he is on the fourth floor, it's up to Collins and Murphy, and they'd better move fast.
Here are the tools, thanks to this lifeline. I'd never find them if I... I'd better leave the axe lashed to the line. We may have to haul it out. Oh, blast that smoke. Oh, come on, can opener. Let's get going. I got this over with. Let's rip it up. Lucky I didn't run into a beam. There she's coming now. Another line. Straight as I can make it. Get the point under. Pry it up. There she goes. Yeah. Oh. That did it. Murphy! Murphy!
Come here, young son.
I've got you, kid. Now don't talk. Try not to breathe. I'll drag you.
Okay.
Okay. I can breathe now.
That's better, kid. Look, the smoke is going up. The wind is taking the web away from us. Are you feeling better?
Yeah, I'm okay. Thanks, Murphy.
Gone in the day's work, kid. You pull me out, I pull you out. How are your legs?
Oh, all right. I'm fine now. Look, Murphy, we better get down into that fourth floor.
Right. Though anything alive in there probably isn't by now.
Yeah, but that shaft is smoking like a chimney. We'd better move as fast as we can. Stick together.
We can make it. Smoke is thinning out. It's finding the way to that other chimney you cut in the roof.
Yeah. All right, all set, Murphy. Here's the stair shaft.
Yeah. Let's go. Now down the stairs, fast. All right. Here's the landing. Hit the deck.
I'm right beside you. There's the door. Better feel it before we open it.
Yeah, let's see.
It's hot, but not too hot.
Well, here's hoping that door isn't locked. Reach up and see. Now, watch it now. If that door's going to blow open...
Look, right back along the wall, Collins. Right up against the wall where the door is. I'll stay on this side so if the door blows out, we won't be in line with it.
All right. Here, take my can opener. Maybe you can...
Yeah, I'll reach up with a point. Juggle the latch. Look out!
Look out for what? It's all right. There's no gas behind that door.
Okay, let's go. Now keep your head down near the floor.
Yeah, it's hot as an oven. But it's cleaner to breathe. Come on. We better crawl in there.
Yeah. Now keep down and follow me. This place is full of crates and boxes.
Yeah.
If we get separated, make for the side wall and find a window. That's where I'm heading now.
Okay, I get it. We smash out the windows and then look around.
What's that, Collins? What'd you say?
Oh, me? I thought that was you.
Hey, listen.
Help me. Hey, there's somebody calling. Murphy, there's somebody in here. Over that way, away from the windows.
Come on over.
No, Murphy, over that way, more to your left.
Never mind that. First we smash out the windows, clear the air, and then look around.
No, not me. I'm going to find that man and pull him out.
Collins, hold it right where you are.
The heck I will. That man, he must be almost done for.
Somebody, I can't move.
I'm going to get you out. I'm going to get him out, Murphy.
Yeah, who's going to get you out?
Huh?
You heard me. We need air, Collins. We got to smash those windows and get air.
Yeah. That's sure, Murphy. You're right. I just lost my head.
And save your breath and follow me.
Oh, just hold on, whoever you are. Hold on. We'll come for you. Soon as we can.
Here's the first one. Back, Collins. Look out for my axe. I'm going to swing.
Crawling through the smoke-filled fourth floor of the warehouse, crawling along the floor, because even the superheated air at that level is better to breathe than the smoke and fumes, Tim Collins follows Murphy to the line of windows, even though off in the murk and gloom, they hear distant cries for help. Will they be in time to locate the source of those terrified calls for aid before fire breaks through from the floor below? Fire Chief Cody and the young rookie fireman Tim Collins will be back tomorrow at the same time and the same station when you hear...
That's it. Let's roll! Let's go! Firefighters!
Firefighters on Tuned to Yesterday from November 24th, 1949, a syndicated recording. We now wrap up this hour of continuing series on Tuned to Yesterday with a broadcast of The Man in the Iron Mask. This was heard on several different radio affiliates as it was a syndicated series. For instance, WTOP, based out of Washington, D.C., picked the program up and surrounded it with an evening of other mysteries like Mr. Keene, Tracer of Lost Persons, Strange Wills, The Sealed Book, and The Weird Circle, all preceding this broadcast heard at around 10:30 at night. This is show number 3 from 1948.
The Man in the Iron Mask.
During their honeymoon off the coast of France, Michael and Louise Dent aboard their luxury yacht reach a strange island. It is here that Michael accidentally stumbles across the secret of the Man in the Iron Mask, a man whose identity has puzzled so many historians for centuries. Michael discovers a secret room above the prison suite which was occupied by the Man in the Iron Mask. He and his wife find a hideous, grinning contraption which is the mask itself. And in a beautiful inlaid writing desk is a faded diary.
I'll have to read slowly, darling. You see, I must translate as I read it.
Here's Michael. Do you mind if I sit near you?
Of course not.
Oh, this horrible piece of metal, this squirting contraption.
The mask?
Yes.
Just a moment. It's a horrible instrument, isn't it? Just imagine that your head is locked at this one, at the back. See?
Oh, awful.
Well, I'd better begin. This is a record of the unfortunate man whom it was my duty to care for from the time when he was a baby until the time long since when he met his death. It has been my secret charge not to reveal his name, and this promise I kept. But I hope in the centuries to come that the kindliness and the valor and the worthiness of this ward of mine will become known to the world of tomorrow. It's signed Georges Saint-Marc.
Who is Georges Saint-Marc?
Well, you learn as I read on. The events which I describe relating to the man and the iron mask have all been pieced together after several years of contemplation. Some of these events I had no knowledge of at the time, but later I learned what I know now and what I have written in this diary. For instance, I did not know at the time, in September 1659, that my ward, who was known as Edmond Martiale, had been frequently meeting the daughter of a peasant farmer on the outskirts of the village where my estate was situated. Picture this little peasant farm in Gascoigne, the apple blossom in full bloom, a bountiful harvest, lush green grass growing by a brook which flowed through Farmer Frederick's land. And Edmond Martiale, my ward, tall, very fair, very good-looking, carrying in his arms the petite Marguerite, daughter of Monsieur Frederick. Already, he stepped gingerly into the shallow running waters of the brook, and the music of the running waters harmonizes with the sweet laughter of his pretty farmer's daughter.
Hold still. If I slip as I carry you across.
What about the geese?
Oh, they'll swim across, silly.
Yes, but who is going to chase them?
Oh, I suppose I'll have to get my teeth wet all over again. There you are. So why we didn't walk down to the boundary fence and across by the little
bridge? It's time for the milking. And walking is new.
I know. It takes us a long time, doesn't it? There's so much to talk about. So much to... Oh, Marguerite. I do love you so.
But why? That's what I can't understand. Oh, Edmund, you don't belong here. Your place is up there on the hill, the Marquis.
But it isn't. I was never happy there. Truly. And if I'd known all these years that I was growing up inside those walls, while you were here on this farm. It's amazing to think that it's only 2 weeks since we met. Just a chance meeting on a country road. Why are you frowning?
Edmund, I'm frightened. You are not for me, I know that. The villagers are beginning to talk.
But why not? I love you, Margaret. Isn't that enough? And you love me. You do, don't you?
Oh, more than anything else on this earth. Ever since that day on the country road when you picked me up and put me on your horse and brought me in, I thought of nobody else. Papa wonders what has happened to me.
What have the villagers been saying?
What they always say about you. That your family must be one of the greatest in France. Because of the goings and comings at the Marquis.
But my family isn't a great family. My guardian Saint-Marc told me so. Don't you see, we're quite ordinary people, really. I understand the Marchialis had a small estate just outside of Paris. And when my father and mother died, I was entrusted to my guardian's care. He's like a father to me, as you know. I've been with him ever since I was a baby. Ever since I can remember.
But your way of life... Oh, Edmund, don't you see? I've been brought up here on this farm. I milk the cows, I look after the geese. I do all the housework for Papa. Look at my hands. Those aren't the hands of the fine ladies that come to your house.
The most beautiful hands I've ever seen. Like butterflies.
Oh, you say the nicest things, Edmund. But don't be nice to me anymore, please. You're going to break my heart, I know you are.
Oh,
I can't see it any other way. If your guardian knew about the two of us, if he knew that... Edmund, you didn't mean it last night when you asked me to...
When I asked you to marry me? Oh, my heart, I just can't live without you. That's the truth.
Have you told your guardian yet?
I intended to tell him at breakfast this morning, but he went out hunting early. I shall tell him tonight. Why, Marguerite, your truck. Look, they're following you across. Well, that saves me another wetting. Oh, darling, what's the matter? You look so unhappy.
Tell me what Monsieur Lamar says, won't you? I almost know before he speaks. But come back to the farm just once and tell me.
When I come back to this farm, I shall take you away. Right up there to the castle on the hill. And one day you'll be mistress of Sanmar Castle. I promise that, sweetheart. I promise it with all my heart.
It's spoilt the hunting. There we were with the prospect of at least 24 partridges, and then this bear crosses our path.
A bear?
Yes, and who should he attack but me? I tell you, it was all I could do to keep him off.
Uncle George.
Yes?
Now that we're alone together here in the library tonight, if you could compose yourself, prepare yourself for a surprise.
A surprise?
I've fallen in love, Uncle George.
In love?
Yes.
I don't understand this. There's no one here in Gascon. I mean, we've had no visitors at the castle since this time last year. No ladies?
This lady lives on the outskirts of the village.
On the outskirts of the village? Who is she?
Her name is Marguerite Frederick. She's the daughter of Papa Frederick, a farmer.
Papa Frederick? You don't... Not that yokel who brings us our pumpkins and our cabbages. Not that white-haired old man with a stick.
Yeah, the same.
And you're in love with his daughter.
I've asked her to marry me.
Asked her to marry... Edmund, are you crazy? Have you taken leave of your senses?
I was never more sane in my life, Uncle. For the first time I know what it is to be alive. To be happy when I hear a bird sing. To exult when I see the sun coming up in the morning. Another day... Another day for me to be with Marguerite.
Edmund, this is a terrible shock. I had no idea. I mean, I looked upon you as just a boy.
Just a boy? But I'm 21, Uncle. Didn't it ever occur to you that I might want to get married?
And you thought years seemed to have rushed over so quickly. Edmund, you can't entertain the idea of marrying a peasant woman.
Listen, Uncle Georges. I've always looked upon you as a father. I love you as a father. But with all my respect and all my love, you can't make me alter my mind. I'm determined that I shall marry Marguerite Frederick. And that's something that nobody can alter. I'm sorry, Uncle, if you don't approve.
Monsieur Fon has arrived by coach from Paris.
Monsieur Fon, don't keep him waiting. Show him in at once.
Oui, monsieur. Will you step this way, Monsieur Fon?
Thank you.
Oh, my dear Cardinal. At last, shut your mouth, all right, lackey. You can go.
Is the country going to your head? You developing into a hobbledehoy village idiot?
My apologies, Cardinal. But the lackey can be trusted. He is my personal servant. In the joy of seeing you, I didn't realize I thought we were alone.
Then be more careful in future. If it got about that Cardinal Mazarin from the court of King Louis was visiting you here of all places...
No, and I'm grievously opposed. I apologize most humbly, my dear Cardinal. Won't you sit down? I'll send for wine.
In a few moments. Let's get down to business first. You sent me an urgent message. Your messenger said he rode all day and all night.
Yes.
I knew that you wouldn't send for me to come personally unless it was something critical. What has happened?
It is my ward. You know who I mean.
Naturally. What is wrong with you?
Not ill in body, but as far as the mind is concerned. Well, if one could call love an illness.
You mean...
He's fallen in love, Cardinal. scandal. He's fallen in love with a peasant girl who lives on the outskirts of the village.
Gosh, this is monstrous. Edmund of all people.
I know. When I heard, I was beside myself with anxiety. I have talked with him, but I have suddenly discovered that he has developed a will of his own, a mind of his own. He is determined to marry this girl.
Marry her? Marry the daughter of a peasant when he is... Yes, of course. This foolishness is catching. I almost said what should never even be breathed. So, Edmund wants to marry. That, of course, is out of the question.
I am powerless. I can do nothing in this matter. The responsibility is now yours, Cardinal. I, like you, realize that if Edmund Marchiali married and there were children, it would wreck France from border to border.
It seems that young Edmund Marchiali is connected in some powerful way with the destiny of France. For here in this room sits Cardinal Mazarin, who is said to rule behind the throne. Make sure you hear the next exciting chapter of The Man in the Iron Mask.
The Man in the Iron Mask, on Tuned to Yesterday, Episode 3, in that 1948 syndicated series, wrapping up this hour of continuing series on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next week at the very same time as we continue these tales from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeFonier. Thanks for listening.